I went to a small Christian high school. I went to a public school and up to middle school and then went over to this Christian high school. And you would think that a class of just a little over 30 people could get along. And you would especially think that a group of about half that number of guys could get along. But that was not the case. Now, much of the time, the guys in my class, we would tolerate each other. You know, we acknowledged each other's existence, but barely, you know. But there was one day, our senior year, where everybody got along. I mean, we were all over at my friend's house, which was actually just a few houses down from my own. And nearly all of us were there, and we're getting along. We're playing video games together and just sitting together and talking, and everybody's getting along. It was surreal. What's both sad and crazy is what brought about that unity. See, we were all skipping school. Now, you know, with a class that size, you wouldn't think that the school would have missed the fact that nearly all the guys in the senior class are missing. But see, that was the genius of our plan. For some reason, they had given us the privilege of going out to pass out this literature throughout the neighborhood. And when we were out supposed to be doing that, it just took one guy to say, "This is dumb." And he decided, "Let's just go over to my house, my friend, I think, who came up with the plan. And you know, they don't know any better. They don't know what we're doing." So at that point, a stack of flyers went into a mailbox. Another stack of flyers was stuck on the top of a car as we drove off, and it went up like confetti. Thankfully, that was not my car. But the question you might be asking is, what, did I say anything? Nope. And not because I didn't want to, but I was a good little tolerant boy who went along with this little act of rebellion without saying a word. And that brings us back to that serene little experience where we're all getting along and happy. See, getting along is great when it's based on truth. But when it's based on a lie, we should call it what it is. It's rebellion. It's not just peace. It's not just unity. It's rebellion. And there is a unity that's good, but there's also a unity that's evil. And we're going to see that today in Genesis chapter 10 and chapter 11. So turn over to Genesis chapter 10. We're kind of going to be coming to a close of our time in Genesis for now. We'll come back to it, but we'll have one more week. We talk a little bit about what's happened up to Genesis 1 through 11. But this morning, we're going to get a chance to see an important truth about unity. And the first thing that we see in chapter 10 is that there is an inherent unity for mankind, an inherent unity of mankind. There's a sense in which we really are all in this together. So look at Genesis chapter 10 and verse 1. And you can see at the beginning of this chapter that we're in a new section. It has that familiar statement at the beginning. These are the generations of the sons of Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Sons were born to them after the flood. So this is the beginning of a new section. We're moving on after the flood to see what happened to humanity, and specifically what happened to Noah's three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And chapter 10 is here yet another genealogy. But this is a little different than what we've seen at this point, because it's not just recording individuals' names. It's recording whole groups of people and even nations it's describing here. Not all these names are actually just individuals. So when it says sons, we can understand that a little more loosely. So for example, in verse 4, you see the words Kittim and Dodanim. Those are actually plural in Hebrew. So it's talking about a whole group of people. And then if you look down a little farther to verse 18, or well, actually verse 16, you have all these ites here, right? You have the Jebusites, the Amorites, the Girgashites, the Hivites, the Arkites, the Sinites, the Arvadites, the Zemarites, the Hamathites, the Termites. That one's not actually in there. I just got carried away. But these are all people groups. So it's not like the other genealogies where you have a list of people, this person and that person begat this person and fathered that person. So there are whole groups of people. There's also these groupings of seven. So you have seven sons of Japheth listed, and then seven grandsons of Japheth listed. Obviously, that's not all the grandsons that he had, too. So the author, Moses, he's being very specific about who he includes and who he doesn't. He likes the number seven. If you look down a little bit farther in verse 13, well, actually in verse the section on Cush, starting in verse 7, it lists five sons and only two grandsons, which adds up to, again, seven. And that's just before there's a little, well, then actually it lists four. In verse 8, it mentions one more descendant. So there's a little pause there. But then Egypt, there's also seven descendants listed there. And there's a little parenthesis there about the Philistines. We'll see why it adds that. He's not part of, those aren't part of the group. But there's, again, this list of seven. Now, if you add up all the names that are included in this list, it comes to 70. There's a selectivity about how many he includes. He includes 70 people in this list. So it's not a comprehensive list of all of the different people that Shem, Ham, and Japheth had, all their descendants. The word sons can be understood not just to be physical sons, but also just descendants in general. And that can include these groups of people. And the focus of Moses' attention here isn't on every single individual possible or every single group or nation possible, but especially the ones that were important to Israel. And that's why Japheth is such a short section, because the people that came from Japheth weren't that familiar to the Israelites. They were out in the north and the west. They were around the Mediterranean Sea. So at the end of that section, he describes them as the coastland peoples. And so he just gives a sufficient number. He gives his seven sons, seven grandsons. That's enough. It's not a comprehensive list, but it is a sufficiently complete list for Israel. And then we're on to Ham's four sons. And it mentions these four sons that three, at least three of them, are the names of nations. So even though they may be individuals named this, and they're the ancestors that led to these nations, the point, the focus is actually on these nations. These are nations that are going to have an impact on Israel. And so it represents Cush by these seven descendants. And then just, again, these descendants that are mentioned are ones that would have been relevant to Israel's life. But then after it gives the representative number seven there for Cush, it pauses at verse 8. And it gives the name of another very important figure, somebody that the Israelites would have known about, the people before they're entering the land of Canaan. They would have known about this person. And so Moses wants to bring him into this genealogy and explain where he comes from, who he is. We need to remember in all this, again, that this is written originally to the group of Israelites that are headed into the promised land. So their time period is going to be what's important for us to pay attention to. Now, he mentions here this figure named Nimrod. And the question we might have is, well, who's Nimrod? And there's lots of different answers to that question. So we can't be sure, but I thought this was a really helpful point from one Bible teacher. He thought that all the details pointed to a very well-known king in that area named Hammurabi. And you say, how in the world do you get Hammurabi from Nimrod? That's a good question. But there is a way to do that. See, Hammurabi is actually an Amorite, and the Amorite people were called the Mardu in the ancient Near East. So you got Mardu, Nimrod, actually have three similar sounds in it, right? The M, the R, and the D. In the right order and everything. Well, it also turns out that one of the words for king is En. So you have En-Mardu. Or there's a word for man that's Na in that language. Na-Mardu is really close to Nimrod. Now, the question is, and that would be roughly equivalent to saying the chief man of the Amorite peoples, which would have been Hammurabi and at least his dynasty. So you have this guy, but the question is, why does Moses make Na-Mardu sound like Nimrod? Well, Na-Mardu, first of all, is not Hebrew. So you have to take that into Hebrew and arrange it. But there's a funny thing that some of the people in the Bible did with names. So we all know, or many of you know, that the word Baal is a description for a god. And there were Israelite names that had the name Baal in them. So in 1 Chronicles, it mentions this guy named Eshbaal, which basically means a man of Baal. Well, in 2 Samuel, that same individual, the writer of Samuel, didn't like the fact that an Israelite had the name of a false god in his name. So he refers to that same person as Ishbosheth, taking out Baal and putting in the Hebrew word for shameful. He's a man of shame now. Now, they would do those kinds of things to reference these different individuals. It just so happens that those combination of sounds that are in Namardu also works perfectly for the Hebrew word for we rebel, Nimrod, or let us rebel. And the point that he's making is that this person is not following God. They're not a person that we would look to, even though they're, we see, legendary in this section. So it'd be like if somebody's name was Werbel, and you just spread out a few words here to make those sound like we rebel instead of just the way that it is. And it draws attention to the fact that humanity is not heading in the right direction. They're not moving in the right direction. So this person that they're well aware of, who we know as Hammurabi, that's my best guess. It could be somebody else. But this person is a legendary leader, and they're ultimately a rebel. Now also, he's the king of, his kingdom begins at, it says in verse 10, Babel, which we're going to get to in chapter 11. So it's drawing attention to this kingdom, and this name that we're going to see a little bit later. So again, it's foreshadowing. We're going to get here in chapter 11. But this king is this legendary king. It says in verse 9, therefore it is said, like Nimrod, a mighty hunter before the Lord. He's a famous warrior king who is also a rebel. It's an important note to keep in mind. Next person in Ham's line is Egypt, and it has those seven names listed there for his descendants. And those are the people, again, that Israel would have thought were important. But he also takes the time to point out the Philistines. And this particular group of people called the Philistines evidently came from Egyptian backgrounds. And so he mentions them because they're going to be the people that are in the land. Egypt is the people that they're actually just now leaving. These are all important people to Israel. He also spends a great deal of time, if you look at all the verses covering Canaan and his descendants. So he spends a great deal of time talking about all the different people that are in the land of Canaan that they're headed for and where they came from. They came from this one descendant. And also he lists out the territory of Canaan. Not all the different countries, not all the different nations that he's listed, just Canaan. Because again, he's focused on Israel and what was true for them at that time. So you can see that Moses is focusing here on the people that Israel knew. He's not giving a comprehensive list, just focusing on the people that Israel knew. And then finally in verse 21, you get to Shem. And we find out here that he's the oldest son. We also find out in verse 21 about this person, an important person in Shem's line named Eber. That's where we get the term Hebrew from. So Eber is a very important line. He's the father of the Hebrews, and it mentions him here. And then it goes on to focus on Shem's line, and it talks about, again, those people that were most relevant to the Israelites. So it mentions the Arameans in verse 23. And then at verse 24, we once again see this genealogy the way that we're used to. You know, this guy fathered that guy, and that guy fathered that other guy, and so on. And he goes in that genealogy to a man by the name of Eber, again, who has two sons, Peleg and Joktan. Now, Peleg's name is explained. He says that in verse 25, the name of the one was Peleg, for in his days the earth was divided, and the word divided sounds like Peleg. So he gets this name here. The world was divided, though, at this point. So the question is, what division is he talking about? If we look back at verse 5, it mentions that these peoples, these coastland peoples, are going to spread out all over the land. And then if you look down to verse 32, that same idea of spreading out, these nations spread abroad on the earth, is mentioned there. And then back up at verse 18, it mentions that the clans of the Canaanites were dispersed. So spreading out, dispersion, division. This is, again, just a way to foreshadow what's going to happen in chapter 11. This chapter is actually out of place. Chapter 11 technically takes place first, but the author wants us to look at chapter 10 first for a reason. Now, Peleg is who he's going to come back to, because Peleg is the line of Abraham. He's the line of promise. But he doesn't focus on him here. Here he focuses on his brother, Joktan, and shows that this prolific brother has had 13 sons. It's one more than Jacob had. So he focuses on that line before coming back to the chosen line, just like he did in chapter 4 with Cain. He focused on Cain before coming back to talk about the chosen line of Seth. That's kind of his pattern. And what he would do is he would go to that not chosen line and talk about it just before a break, where he's going to point something out about humanity that's wrong, something that's not going right. And then he's going to come back to God's promise and God's plan. So at the end of this section, and actually the end of each section, it mentions these divisions. Moses mentions the division of lands, languages, clans, nations. The world is divided in Israel's day by these things. So it's divided by geography. It's divided by language, by personal relationships, political groups. These are the divisions that existed in Israel's day. But what this chapter is pointing out is that in spite of those divisions, we are all from the same family. We are all, even though there are differences, we are all united in the sense that we come from the same family. Now, one of the offspring of Darwinian evolution was this thing called eugenics. Now, there's different things talked about for eugenics today, but the basic idea by the time Hitler comes around is Hitler used that idea to talk about having a pure and superior race. So he believed that the German people were superior. And that's in spite of the fact that when he went to the Olympics, there was this black gentleman named Jesse Owens who beat the snot out of every single runner in every event that he was in. But he still believed that the Germans were superior. He believed that to the point of killing millions of Jews goes against what this chapter is saying. We're all part of the same family. There's no superiority. And we could say, well, Hitler, you know, those terrible Germans, look at what they did. But America can't do that, can we? Because the same kind of reasoning was held by even people that would call themselves Bible-believing Christians. The attitude that they had for slaves. They believed that they were inherently better than slaves. They used that kind of thinking and even tried to use the Bible in some way to justify owning another person because that person wasn't as important as them, wasn't as valuable as them. And that's a sad part of our history as Southern Baptists. We got that terribly wrong. So when we look at this passage here in chapter 10, what it's telling us is that we all came from the same source. We have the same origin. We should never look at a fellow human and say, I'm better than that person. I'm inherently better than them. See, these divisions, they don't make us ultimately different than each other. There's no segment of humanity that is more important, more valuable, better than another segment of humanity. And we should defend that kind of equality as Christians because we believe the Bible and what it says. Now, here's where the rubber meets the road, because we may think, yes, on paper, everyone is equal. But the question is, do we look down on certain people just because they're different than us? Do we automatically make assumptions about people based on the color of their skin or on the clothing that they wear? Do we automatically look down on people because they're different than us? We all struggle with this. It's a natural tendency, this way that we are as sinful humans. That cannot be the case. And just in case you want to exempt yourself from this, or I want to exempt myself from this, which this is a very dangerous thing, this is an error, this is sin, but just in case we want to say that we're above this, I want us to consider how we would feel if we could actually go back in time and look at Jesus face to face, only to find that we're looking at a Middle Eastern man in a headdress that looks remarkably similar to people that we look at and judge and even have hateful thoughts towards today. Instead of sharing the love of that Middle Eastern man with them, reality is we are not different. at the end of the day, we are all part of one family. And it's problematic if we think of a person and have hateful thoughts of them just based on what they're dressing in and what they look like. That's not Christianity. That's not what the Bible teaches. We are unity where there's a unity of humanity. There is something that is good. We are all part of one people. And we need to pay attention to what this passage is actually saying. See, the word in verse 32 for clans is the exact same word for families just a little bit later in chapter 12 and verse 3. That's where God told Abraham that he had a plan to bless all of these different clans, all these different families. See, God loves all these different people. He had a plan for all these different people. Back in chapter 12, or later in chapter 12, it was going to point out to Israel that the purpose of their existence wasn't just for themselves. It was for all those different families. So if God loves all these different families, then we ought to too. And there's no excuse for the hatred we might feel in our hearts for somebody just based on an external difference. Or even a religious difference. I'm not exonerating Islam and saying Islam's fine. We'll see that as we go forward. But Islam is a religion. It's not a people. We need to love every member of humanity. And that's what this verse teaches. See, at the end of the day, if we look at some picture of somebody and just automatically have angry thoughts, we might as well just start going by the name Nimrod. Because that's rebellion against God and his plan for humanity. And it's a very important thing that we see this unity because of what we're about to look at. See, there's a unity that's good and inherent. We're all part of one big human family, one big human race. But there's also a unity that's evil. And we see that in chapter 11. So look over at chapter 11. And we move from the inherent humanity, or the inherent unity of mankind, to the evil unity of mankind. So look at verses 1 through 9. We'll just go ahead and read those together. It says, "Now the whole earth had one language and the same words. And as people migrated from the east, they found a plain in the land of Shinar and settled there. And they said to one another, 'Come, let us make bricks and burn them thoroughly.' And they had brick for stone and bitumen for mortar. Then they said, 'Come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower with its top in the heavens, and let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be dispersed over the face of the whole earth.' And the Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the children of man had built. And the Lord said, 'Behold, they are one people, and they have all one language. And this is only the beginning of what they will do. And nothing that they propose to do will be now impossible for them. Come, let us go down and there confuse their language, so that they may not understand one another's speech.' So the Lord dispersed them from there over the face of all the earth, and they left off building the city. Therefore, its name was called Babel, because there the Lord confused the language of all the earth. And from there the Lord dispersed them over the face of all the earth." Now, this story is actually told in a very beautiful and organized way. And especially in the original, you could see that in the original Hebrew. This is once again an example of this thing that we talked about with the flood, a chiasm. This is a way of telling a story that ends up making a shape of an X, which is the same shape as the letter chi. So the thing that's mentioned at the first part of the first half of the story happens at the last part of the second half of the story, and the thing that happens at the end of the first half happens at the beginning of the second half. So it makes this X. And what's interesting is that not only was Moses able to do that, but he also does this thing called paneling, where you word things in such a way that two halves of the story describe the same sequence. How he was able to do that, I mean, it's really a remarkable thing that he put together for this. But what's important in understanding that is that in the middle of those panels is a verse, and at the center of that X is a verse. It's verse 5. It's central to what God is doing here. It's God taking action. So ultimately, this is a story about God taking action. As we're going to see, it's an action of judgment. See, when he comes down to see the tower, that language isn't talking about God not knowing what's going on, so he comes down to check it out. That's the language of God basically putting on his judicial robes and coming to make a verdict on what humanity's doing. He's coming down to take action just like he's going to do in chapter 19 with Sodom and Gomorrah. It's the same language. It's the same kind of terminology. He's coming to make a verdict. That's what he's doing here. And so this ultimately is a story about God's judgment on humanity. So let's look back at verse 1, where you can see that the whole earth, that means everyone in the world, has one language. They have the same language. There's no division at this point in the story. And verse 2 describes humanity as a whole, all going and migrating from Ararat, where the ark had landed, to these plains of Shinar, this land between the two rivers, the Tigris and the Euphrates, the land of Mesopotamia, which is in modern-day Iraq. So they all settled there. Now, often people say that this was a sin, that they're gathering together and maintaining this being together, not spreading out, was a sin. I mean, didn't God say, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth? He said that in chapter 9, right? But the question is, do you have to spread out in order to fill something? I don't think you do. I don't think that's what's going on here. I don't think that what God said in being multiplying and being fruitful and multiplying necessitates spreading out. When you look at the filling the earth, that comes as a result of multiplying and being fruitful. That's how you fill the earth, not by spreading out. Now, the idea that this was sinful would have more traction if God was clearly against cities. But he chose a city, right? He chose Jerusalem. And in fact, he chooses to describe the new heavens and the new earth one day as a city. So I don't think God has anything against cities. I don't think that he has that attitude. On top of that, when God blessed humanity and said, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth, it was a blessing. It wasn't a command. And so as Jacob puts it to Joseph, when God blesses us, he isn't so much telling us what to do as he's telling us what he's going to do. So again, it's not really a problem for them to congregate. So what is the problem? Well, look at verse 3. They decide that they're going to develop this technology with bricks. Now, it's not as advanced as an interlocking brick system like Legos, but it is an advancement. And the question is, why is he telling us this? Well, the first question we should ask is, why is he telling Israel this? See, in Egypt and in Canaan, they had an abundance of stone. They didn't make bricks. They didn't need bricks. They had stone and mortar. So he's telling them this detail about what they were doing because it tells you something about this building. See, not every building would have been made with bricks because that takes time to make bricks for a big building like this. And you know, time is money. So this is a costly endeavor. So this tells you that this building is very important. This is not just any building. And Moses goes on in verse 4 to tell us what the people say. They say, come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower with its top in the heavens. So what we're looking at here is the development of urbanization. It's the first time that humanity as a large population is trying to get together and form a city. Now, we did mention a city earlier with Cain, but that was more like a fort that he was using to kind of keep himself safe. This is a city based on the idea of getting a big population together, especially as it gets harder and harder to use the same resources. Now, there were towers in the ancient world called ziggurats, and they were more or less glorified staircases. So this is a stairway to heaven, if you will. But the people who built them didn't actually use the stairs. So they built this staircase, but then they didn't use them. It wasn't for them. It was for the gods. So really, this wasn't so much a stairway to heaven. It was a stairway to earth. It was their invitation to the gods to come to them and bless them so that they could survive. So as Dr. Walton puts it, the Tower of Babel project is a temple complex featuring a ziggurat, the stairway, which is designed to make it convenient for the god to come down to his temple, receive worship from the people, and bless them. And at first that sounds like a pretty good deal. I mean, they want God to come down and help them survive. That's great. Except it's obviously not great. So what's the problem? Well, The question is, does God need an invitation from us to be a part of our lives? Does God need a stairway in order to get to us? No. So one of the emphases in the Old Testament is that we need to worship God the way he wants to be worshiped. Because how you worship God is an indication of what you think about him. It matters how you approach God because it matters what you think about him. And the way you approach him gives evidence of how you think about him. And so this is very important. These people here are building something that's not putting God first. They're putting themselves first. The ultimate goal, it says here in verse 4, for this is, let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be dispersed over the whole face of the earth. So the tower isn't really first about worshiping God. The tower is first and foremost about their own welfare and about their own notoriety. So it's not about letting everybody else know how great God is. It's about letting everybody know how great they are. They were created, in a sense, as a monument, as an image of God to point to God's greatness. Now they're creating a monument that points to their own greatness. This is selfish, self-centered religion. God is now included in their plans. They're not trying to include themselves in God's plans, though. He needs to fit into their plans and what they're doing. So even though God made man in his image, now humanity is starting to return the favor because they're starting to look at God the way that people are. They're starting to look at God as though he has needs, just like people have needs. What they're essentially saying is, God, come on down. We'll help you out if you help us out. It's like a bartering system with God. So look at how verse 5 responds. God responds there. They want him to come down. And ironically, this is what the text says. And the Lord came down. The only problem is he's not coming down the way that they want him to come down. They think he's going to come down and bless them. But he's not coming down as their benefactor. He's coming down as their judge. He's coming down to preside over the trial of humanity versus God. And it's really over before it starts. If you look at verse 6, we get a window into God's deliberation again. Just like we heard about God in chapter 3, God tells us about what he's thinking, what he says. And so the triune God says to himself, behold, they are one people, and they have all one language, and this is only the beginning of what they will do. And nothing that they propose to do will now be impossible for them. Once again, you have that climactic word, behold. Look at their unity. God's saying, look at what this big happy family has chosen to do. They're inventing the institutionalized false religion. They're creating a false religion that they're all in agreement on. So if they stick together, God's saying this perversion, this self-centered worship, this human-centered religion is only going to get worse from here. They're going to be committed altogether to their own priorities, to their own glory. They're not going to be committed to God and his glory. They're not here to do what God created them to do. They're here to try to get their creator to do what they want him to do. And that's just going to get worse and worse. It's going to be people living out their version of good and evil, their version with that knowledge that they now have on their own, based basically just on popular consent. That's what it looks like. Now, you might say, well, at least they're not killing anybody like they did before. I mean, this doesn't seem as bad as what it was like in Genesis chapter 6 before the flood. But that's just it. That's not what God says. He doesn't say, well, you know, it's too bad. I mean, it'd be nice if they would do what I created them for, but at least they're not killing anybody. That's not what he says. Verse 7 gives the verdict. Because of how evil this is, he actually divides humanity. Humanity's all together. They're united. And he creates division, something we associate as bad in all cases. We don't want division, we want unity. He is the author of division here because of how bad this unity is. And verse 8 gives the results. It's the division that we already heard about in chapter 10. We got the hints, we knew what was coming because we saw these different nations that are divided by languages and lands. And now we see God carry it out. And then verse 9 gives this ironic ending. They built this tower to make a name for themselves, and they do end up making a name. But it's not the name that they thought they were going to get. It's not a name that shows how great they are. It's Babel, and it's a name that shows their confusion. It's the same word, actually. Babel is the same word for the kingdom of Babylon. Babylon became a powerful nation. We saw that with Nimrod. It became a dominant kingdom in the area. And it also became a symbol for false religion. It was the kind of crown jewel of the ancient Near East. Every kingdom that existed in the ancient Near East wanted to rule Babylon. It was an important city. So it's very appropriate for Israel to now understand the word Babel to mean confusion. So they're not tempted to think, this really is a great place. This is the author of, this is the source of false religion. Now when we look at a story like this, I think we have the tendency to minimize what's going on here. But this really is rebellion. So sometimes peace is actually rebellion. Sometimes unity is rebellion. That's a hard thing to wrap our heads around, I think, sometimes. And what scares me is the thought of the church today being somewhat like sometimes the church in Germany around the time of Nazi Germany. There was a tendency in that church to downplay some of the bad things in Hitler's speeches because of the good things that they heard in them. And what happened was, what started out as a little trickle of the current of their culture turned into rapids. And they got caught up in something that in the end they didn't really want to be a part of, but it was too late. So the devil really is in the details. It's important to pay attention to what's really going on and what people are really saying. Sometimes we could think that being a critical thinker is the same thing as being critical. It's not. It's important for us to be discerning because we don't want to get caught up in the Babel, the Tower of Babel enterprises in our day. We don't want to be caught with bricks in our hands. And whether we realize it or not, this world is being run by the prince of the power of the air. And maybe you haven't noticed, but he does seem to be working really hard at getting everybody to get along, getting all the nations and the religions to get along. The watchword here is tolerance. As far as I can tell, there's really only two problems for that plan. One's violent Islam, and the other's Bible-believing Christianity. And since Satan's also using Islam, you can bet that at some point he's going to figure out how to zero in and make it just one problem. Bible believing Christianity. We want to make sure that we are in that spot of not going with Satan's programming. So we can love the world and not be unified with them. It's not just about getting along. It's very important for us to think critically and recognize that sometimes the job that we might be working on, this job that everybody's working to achieve, this peace, is actually rebellion against God. We need to pay attention to what we're doing. And I've heard in recent days people that are claiming to be Christians and are saying at the same time that they have this solidarity with these people that want to kill unborn children or with people that are deciding to discard God's view of marriage between a man and a woman. Now, we can and we must love people, but for some reason these people that claim to be Christians think that it's unloving to say, I can't agree with you. It's not unloving to say that. You can love those who carry out abortions and who choose to marry somebody of the same gender. You can love them and still disagree about what they're doing. You can love them as the image bearers that they really are and work to keep their practices from taking deeper root into our country. You can do both of those things. It's not unloving to love them as people and still not agree with what they're doing. Chapter 10, I think, is put ahead of chapter 11 so that we'll see that. So that we'll recognize that we are diverse, that we're a group of people that's all one big family. That we should never look down on other people that are different than us. But then we get to chapter 11 and realize that there is some types of unity that we cannot have. It's outside of our purview. We're not able to get on board. So what the world needs isn't our approval. They need Jesus. They need to recognize that We weren't created just to be nice people who get along with others and play nice. We were created to worship and enjoy God, and anything other than that is evil. They need to hear that their sin is actually rebellion against this God. They don't need us to just join them in that. And what it sometimes looked like is if we listen to them, if we help them, if we get along with them, then that's what friendship is, right? We can be their friends. But listen to what James says. He says, whoever wishes to be a friend of the world makes himself an enemy of God. There are some friendships that we cannot have. We could still love them. And we can be friends in another sense, but not in the sense of joining them. We can be different and loving. So the world doesn't need us to join their side. They need to understand that they're on the wrong side. They don't need us to just pick up a brick and follow them. They need to see that what they're doing, even in trying to attain peace altogether, when it leaves God out, it's rebellion. It's not neutral. It's not little. It's not a small thing. What we all need to do is to recognize that we are born into this world as rebels, that need to recognize that as sin and not want to be that way, and to actually genuinely put our trust in Christ. And through faith in Christ, we're able to be what God created us to be, which is people who worship and enjoy God. And that's the kind of unity that we can all get on board with. Let's pray. Father, you truly are most important. It matters how we approach you. It matters how we think of you. It matters how you're a part of our world. Father, I pray that we would not be the kind of undiscerning people who miss what's actually going on, who don't realize what's happening with the movement in this world to create world peace. That it's a peace and a unity that is leaving you out, and it's as evil and wicked as was happening when you divided the peoples at the Tower of Babel. Help us to recognize that it's not unloving when we're the only divisive people in the group who are unwilling to say everybody's okay, who are unwilling to say, you don't need Jesus. You can go your way and we'll go ours and we'll all get there together. Father, help us to understand how important it is for us to believe your word, to love everyone, to not be hateful towards the different people in our world, to not be hateful towards those who commit abortion, to not hate those who choose to marry their same gender, to never be hateful towards them, to love them, to recognize that they're a part of our human family, but to also be discerning enough to recognize that we cannot agree with them, that we're bound by your instruction, and that we would point them to what all of us need, which is Christ. Give us the kind of backbone and heart that we need in our day-to-day, the kind of compassion we need for others, and boldness to be who you've called us to be. I pray that you give us the right balance in that way. In Jesus' name, amen.